Candide by Voltaire. Chapter 1. How Candide was brought up in a magnificent castle, and how he was expelled thence. In a castle of Westphalia, belonging to the Baron of Thunder Tentronck, lived a youth whom nature had endowed with the most gentle manners. His countenance was a true picture of his soul. He combined an honest judgment with simplicity of spirit, which was the reason, I believe, of his being called Candide. The old servants of the family suspected him to have been the son of the Baron's sister by a good, honest gentleman of the neighbourhood, whom that young lady would never marry because he had been able to prove only 71 quarterings, the rest of his genealogical tree having been lost through the injuries of time. The Baron was one of the most powerful lords in Westphalia, for his castle had not only a gate, but windows. His great hall even was hung with tapestry. All the dogs of his farmyards formed a pack of hounds at need. His grooms were his huntsmen, and the curate of the village was his grand almoner. They called him my lord, and laughed at all his stories. The Baron's lady weighed about 350 pounds, and was therefore a person of great consideration, and she did the honours of the house with a dignity that commanded still greater respect. Her daughter Cunigonde was 17 years of age, fresh-coloured, comely, plump, and desirable. The Baron's son seemed to be in every respect worthy of his father. The preceptor Pangloss was the oracle of the family, and little Candide heard his lessons with all the good faith of his age and character. Pangloss was professor of metaphysico-theologico-cosmolo-nigology. He proved admirably that there is no effect without a cause, and that in this best of all possible worlds, the Baron's castle was the most magnificent of castles, and his lady the best of all possible baronesses. "It is demonstrable," said he, "that things cannot be otherwise than as they are, for all being created for an end, all is necessarily for the best end. Observe that the nose has been formed to bear spectacles. Thus we have spectacles. Legs are visibly designed for stockings, and we have stockings. Stones were made to be hewn and to construct castles. Therefore, my lord has a magnificent castle. For the greatest baron in the province ought to be the best lodged. Pigs were made to be eaten. Therefore, we eat pork all the year round. Consequently, they who assert that all is well have said a foolish thing. They should have said, all is for the best." Candide listened attentively and believed innocently, for he thought Miss Cunigonde extremely beautiful, though he never had the courage to tell her so. He concluded that after the happiness of being born of Baron Thunder Tentronck, the second degree of happiness was to be Miss Cunigonde, the third, that of seeing her every day, and the fourth, that of hearing Master Pangloss, the greatest philosopher of the whole province, and consequently of the whole world. One day, Cunigonde, while walking near the castle, in a little wood which they called a park, saw between the bushes Dr. Pangloss giving a lesson in experimental natural philosophy to her mother's chambermaid, a little brown wench, very pretty and very docile. As Miss Cunigonde had a great disposition for the sciences, she breathlessly observed the repeated experiments of which she was a witness. She clearly perceived the force of the doctor's reasons, the effects, and the causes. She turned back greatly flurried, quite pensive, and filled with a desire to be learned. Dreaming that she might well be a sufficient reason for young Candide, and he for her. She met Candide on reaching the castle and blushed. Candide blushed also. She wished him good morrow in a faltering tone, and Candide spoke to her without knowing what he said. The next day after dinner, as they went from table, Cunigonde and Candide found themselves behind a screen. Cunigonde let fall her handkerchief. Candide picked it up. She took him innocently by the hand. The youth as innocently kissed the young lady's hand with particular vivacity, sensibility, and grace. Their lips met. Their eyes sparkled, their knees trembled, their hands strayed. Baron Thundertent Trunk passed near the screen, and beholding this cause and effect, chased Candide from the castle with great kicks on the backside. Cunegonde fainted away. She was boxed on the ears by the Baroness as soon as she came to herself, and all was consternation in this most magnificent and most agreeable of all possible castles. Chapter 2. What became of Candide among the Bulgarians? Candide, driven from terrestrial paradise, walked a long while without knowing where, weeping, raising his eyes to heaven, turning them often towards the most magnificent of castles which imprisoned the purest of noble young ladies. He lay down to sleep without supper in the middle of a field between two furrows. The snow fell in large flakes. Next day, Candide, all benumbed, dragged himself towards the neighbouring town which was called Waldberghof Trarpgdikdorf. Having no money, dying of hunger and fatigue, he stopped sorrowfully at the door of an inn. Two men, dressed in blue, observed him. "Comrade," said one, "here is a well-built young fellow, and of proper height." They went up to Candide and very civilly invited him to dinner. "Gentlemen," replied Candide with the most engaging modesty, "you do me great honour, but I have not wherewithal to pay my share."
"Oh, sir," said one of the blues to him, "people of your appearance and of your merit never pay anything. Are you not 5 feet, 5 inches high?"
"Yes, sir, that is my height," answered he, making a low bow.
"Oh, come, sir, seat yourself. Not only will we pay your reckoning, but we will never suffer such a man as you to want money. Men are only born to assist one another."
"Oh, you are right," said Candide. "This is what I was always taught by Mr. Pangloss, and I see plainly that all is for the best." They begged of him to accept a few crowns. He took them and wished to give them his note. They refused. They seated themselves at table.
"Love you not deeply?"
Yes, answered he. "I deeply love Miss Cunegonde." "No," said one of the gentlemen. "We ask you if you do not deeply love the King of the Bulgarians."
Not at all, said he, "for I have never seen him."
"What? He is the best of kings, and we must drink his health."
Very willingly, gentlemen. And he drank.
"That is enough," they tell him. "Now you are the help, the support, the defender, the hero of the Bulgarians. Your fortune is made, and your glory is assured."
Instantly they fettered him and carried him away to the regiment. There he was made to wheel about to the right and to the left, to draw his rammer, to return his rammer, to present, to fire, to march, and they gave him 30 blows with a cudgel. The next day he did his exercise a little less badly, and he received but 20 blows. The day following, they gave him only 10, and he was regarded by his comrades as a prodigy. Candide, all stupefied, could not yet very well realize how he was a hero. He resolved one fine day in spring to go for a walk, marching straight before him, believing that it was a privilege of the human as well as of the animal species to make use of their legs as they pleased. He had advanced 2 leagues when he was overtaken by 4 others, heroes of 6 feet, who bound him and carried him to a dungeon. He was asked which he would like the best, to be whipped 36 times through all the regiment, or to receive at once 12 balls of lead in his brain. He vainly said that human will is free, and that he chose neither the one nor the other. He was forced to make a choice. He determined, in virtue of that gift of God called liberty, to run the gauntlet 36 times. He bore this 2x. The regiment was composed of 2,000 men. That composed for him 4,000 strokes, which laid bare all his muscles and nerves from the nape of his neck quite down to his rump. As they were going to proceed to a 3rd whipping, Candide, able to bear no more, begged as a favour that they would be so good as to shoot him. He obtained this favour. They bandaged his eyes and bade him kneel down. The King of the Bulgarians passed at this moment and ascertained the nature of the crime. As he had great talent, He understood from all that he learnt of Candide that he was a young metaphysician, extremely ignorant of the things of this world, and he accorded him his pardon with a clemency which will bring him praise in all the journals and throughout all ages. An able surgeon cured Candide in 3 weeks by means of emollients taught by Dioscorides. He had already a little skin, and was able to march when the king of the Bulgarians gave battle to the king of the Abares. Chapter 3. How Candide made his escape from the Bulgarians, and what afterwards became of him. There was never anything so gallant, so spruce, so brilliant, and so well disposed as the two armies. Trumpets, fifes, oboes, drums, and cannon made music such as hell itself had never heard. The cannons, first of all, laid flat about 6,000 men on each side. The muskets swept away from this best of worlds 9,000 or 10,000 ruffians who infested its surface. The bayonet was also a sufficient reason for the death of several thousands. The whole might amount to 30,000 souls. Candide, who trembled like a philosopher, hid himself as well as he could during this heroic butchery. At length, while the two kings were causing Te Deum to be sung each in his own camp, Candide resolved to go and reason elsewhere on effects and causes. He passed over heaps of dead and dying, and first reached a neighbouring village. It was in cinders. It was an Abari village which the Bulgarians had burnt according to the laws of war. Here, old men covered with wounds beheld their wives hugging their children to their bloody breasts, massacred before their faces. There, their daughters, disemboweled and breathing their last after having satisfied the natural wants of Bulgarian heroes, while others, half burnt in the flames, begged to be dispatched. The earth was scattered with brains, arms, and legs. Candide fled quickly to another village. It belonged to the Bulgarians, and the Abarian heroes had treated it in the same way. Candide, walking always over palpitating limbs or across ruins, arrived at last beyond the seat of war, with a few provisions in his knapsack, and Miss Cunegonde always in his heart. His provisions failed him when he arrived in Holland, but having heard that everybody was rich in that country, and that they were Christians, he did not doubt but he should meet with the same treatment from them as he had met with in the Baron's castle, before Miss Cunegonde's bright eyes were the cause of his expulsion thence. He asked alms of several grave-looking people, who all answered him that if he continued to follow this trade, they would confine him to the House of Correction, where he should be taught to get a living. The next he addressed was a man who had been haranguing a large assembly for a whole hour on the subject of charity. But the orator, looking askew, said, "What are you doing here? Are you for the good cause?" "There can be no effect without a cause," modestly answered Candide. "The whole is necessarily concatenated and arranged for the best. It was necessary for me to have been banished from the presence of Miss Cunegonde, to have afterwards run the gauntlet, and now it is necessary I should beg my bread until I learn to earn it. All this cannot be otherwise."
"My friend," said the orator to him, "do you believe the Pope to be Antichrist?"
I have not heard it," answered Candide, "but whether he be, or whether he be not, I want bread."
"Thou dost not deserve to eat," said the other. "Begone, rogue! Begone, wretch! Do not come near me again."
The orator's wife, putting her head out of the window, and spying a man that doubted whether the Pope was Antichrist, poured over him a full... Oh, heavens! To what excess does religious zeal carry the ladies? A man who had never been christened, a good Anabaptist named James, beheld the cruel and ignominious treatment shown to one of his brethren, an unfeathered biped with a rational soul. He took him home, cleaned him, gave him bread and beer, presented him with 2 florins, and even wished to teach him the manufacture of Persian stuffs which they make in Holland. Candide, almost prostrating himself before him, cried, "Master Pangloss has well said that all is for the best in this world, for I am infinitely more touched by your extreme generosity than with the inhumanity of that gentleman in the black coat and his lady." The next day, as he took a walk, he met a beggar all covered with scabs, his eyes diseased, the end of his nose eaten away, his mouth distorted, his teeth black, choking in his throat, tormented with a violent cough, and spitting out a tooth at each effort. Chapter 4. how Candide found his old master Pangloss, and what happened to them. Candide, yet more moved with compassion than with horror, gave to this shocking beggar the 2 florins which he had received from the honest Anabaptist James. The spectre looked at him very earnestly, dropped a few tears, and fell upon his neck. Candide recoiled in disgust.
"Alas!" said one wretch to the other, "do you no longer know your dear Pangloss?"
"What do I hear? You, my dear master? You in this terrible plight? Oh, what misfortune has happened to you? Why are you no longer in the most magnificent of castles? What has become of Miss Cunegonde, the pearl of girls, and nature's masterpiece?"
"I am so weak that I cannot stand," said Pangloss.
Upon which Candide carried him to the Anabaptist's stable and gave him a crust of bread. As soon as Pangloss had refreshed himself a little,
"Well," said Candide, "Cunegonde?"
"Oh, she is dead," replied the other.
Candide fainted at this word. His friend recalled his senses with a little bad vinegar which he found by chance in the stable. Candide reopened his eyes.
"Cunegonde is dead? Ah, best of worlds, where art thou? But of what illness did she die? Was it not for grief, upon seeing her father kick me out of his magnificent castle?"
"No," said Pangloss. "She was ripped open by the Bulgarian soldiers, after having been violated by many. They broke the baron's head for attempting to defend her. My lady, her mother, was cut in pieces. My poor pupil was served just in the same manner as his sister. And as for the castle, they have not left one stone upon another. Not a barn, nor a sheep, nor a duck, nor a tree. But we have had our revenge, for the Abares have done the very same thing to a neighbouring barony which belonged to a Bulgarian lord."
At this discourse Candide fainted again, but coming to himself, and having said all that it became him to say, inquired into the cause and effect, as well as into the sufficient reason that had reduced Pangloss to so miserable a plight.
"Alas," said the other, "it was love. Love, the comfort of the human species, the preserver of the universe, the soul of all sensible beings. Love, tender love."
"Alas," said Candide, "I know this love, that sovereign of hearts, that soul of our souls. Yet it never cost me more than a kiss and 20 kicks on the backside. How could this beautiful cause produce in you an effect so abominable?" Pangloss made answer in these terms.
"Oh, my dear Candide, you remember Paquette, that pretty wench who waited on our noble baroness? In her arms I tasted the delights of paradise, which produced in me those hell torments with which you see me devoured. She was infected with them. She is perhaps dead of them. This present Paquette received of a learned grey friar who had traced it to its source. He had had it of an old countess who had received it from a cavalry captain who owed it to a marchioness who took it from a page who had received it from a Jesuit who, when a novice, had it in a direct line from one of the companions of Christopher Columbus. For my part, I shall give it to nobody. I am dying."
"Oh, Pangloss," cried Candide, "what a strange genealogy. Is not the devil the original stock of it?"
"Oh, not at all," replied this great man. "It was a thing unavoidable, a necessary ingredient in the best of worlds. For if Columbus had not in an island of America caught this disease, which contaminates the source of life, frequently even hinders generation, and which is evidently opposed to the great end of nature, we should have neither chocolate nor cochineal. We are also to observe that upon our continent this distemper is like religious controversy, confined to a particular spot. The Turks, the Indians, the Persians, the Chinese, the Siamese, the Japanese know nothing of it. But there is a sufficient reason for believing that they will know it in their turn in a few centuries. In the meantime, it has made marvellous progress among us, especially in those great armies composed of honest, well-disciplined hirelings who decide the destiny of states. For we may safely affirm that when an army of 30,000 men fights another of an equal number, there are about 20,000 of them poxed on each side.
"Well, this is wonderful," said Candide, "but you must get cured."
"Alas, how can I?" said Pangloss. "I have not a farthing, my friend, and all over the globe there is no letting of blood or taking a glister without paying, or somebody paying for you."
These last words determined Candide. He went and flung himself at the feet of the charitable Anabaptist James, and gave him so touching a picture of the state to which his friend was reduced, that the good man did not scruple to take Dr. Pangloss into his house, and had him cured at his expense. In the cure, Pangloss lost only an eye and an ear. He wrote well, and knew arithmetic perfectly. The Anabaptist James made him his bookkeeper. At the end of 2 months, being obliged to go to Lisbon about some mercantile affairs, he took the two philosophers with him in his ship. Pangloss explained to him how everything was so constituted that it could not be better. James was not of this opinion.
"It is more likely," said he, "mankind have a little corrupted nature, for they were not born wolves, and they have become wolves. God has given them neither cannon of 24-pounders nor bayonets, and yet they have made cannon and bayonets to destroy one another. Into this account I might throw not only bankrupts, but justice which seizes on the effects of bankrupts to cheat the creditors."
"All this was indispensable," replied the one-eyed doctor, "for private misfortunes make the general good, so that the more private misfortunes there are, the greater is the general good."
While he reasoned, the sky darkened, the winds blew from the four quarters, and the ship was assailed by a most terrible tempest within sight of the port of Lisbon. Chapter 5. Tempest, shipwreck, earthquake, and what became of Dr. Pangloss, Candide, and James the Anabaptist. Half dead of that inconceivable anguish which the rolling of a ship produces, one half of the passengers were not even sensible of the danger. The other half shrieked and prayed. The sheets were rent, the masts broken, the vessel gaped. Work who would, no one heard, no one commanded. The Anabaptist, being upon deck, bore a hand, when a brutish sailor struck him roughly and laid him sprawling. But with the violence of the blow, he himself tumbled head foremost overboard and stuck upon a piece of the broken mast. Honest James ran to his assistance, hauled him up, and from the effort he made was precipitated into the sea in sight of the sailor, who left him to perish without deigning to look at him. Candide drew near and saw his benefactor, who rose above the water one moment and was then swallowed up forever. He was just going to jump after him, but was prevented by the philosopher Pangloss, who demonstrated to him that the Bay of Lisbon had been made on purpose for the Anabaptist to be drowned. While he was proving this a priori, the ship foundered. All perished except Pangloss, Candide, and that brutal sailor who had drowned the good Anabaptist. The villain swam safely to the shore, while Pangloss and Candide were borne thither upon a plank. As soon as they recovered themselves a little, they walked toward Lisbon. They had some money left, with which they hoped to save themselves from starving, after they had escaped drowning. Scarcely had they reached the city, lamenting the death of their benefactor, when they felt the earth tremble under their feet. The sea swelled and foamed in the harbour, and beat to pieces the vessels riding at anchor. Whirlwinds of fire and ashes covered the streets and public places. Houses fell, roofs were flung upon the pavements, and the pavements were scattered. 30,000 inhabitants of all ages and sexes were crushed under the ruins. A sailor, whistling and swearing, said there was booty to be gained here.
"What can be the sufficient reason of this phenomenon?" said Pangloss.
"Oh, this is the last day!" cried Candide.
The sailor ran among the ruins, facing death to find money, Finding it, he took it, got drunk, and having slept himself sober, purchased the favours of the first good-natured wench whom he met on the ruins of the destroyed houses, and in the midst of the dying and the dead. Pangloss pulled him by the sleeve.
"My friend," said he, "this is not right. You sin against the universal reason. You choose your time badly."
"'Sblood and fury!' answered the other. "'I'm a sailor and born at Batavia. 4 times I've trampled upon the crucifix in 4 voyages to Japan. A fig for thy universal reason!'
Some falling stones had wounded Candide. He lay stretched in the street, covered with rubbish.
"'Alas!' said he to Pangloss. "'Get me a little wine and oil. I am dying.'
"'Oh, this concussion of the earth is no new thing,' answered Pangloss. "'The city of Lima, in South America, experienced the same convulsions last year. The same cause, the same effect. There is certainly a train of sulphur underground from Lima to Lisbon.'
"'Oh, nothing is more probable,' said Candide. "'But for the love of God, a little oil and wine?'
"'Probable,' replied the philosopher. "'I maintain that the point is demonstrable.'
Candide fainted away, and Pangloss fetched him some water from a neighbouring fountain. The following day they rummaged among the ruins and found provisions, with which they repaired their exhausted strength. After this they joined with others in relieving those inhabitants who had escaped death. Some, whom they had succoured, gave them as good a dinner as they could in such disastrous circumstances. True, the repast was mournful, and the company moistened their bread with tears. But Pangloss consoled them, assuring them that things could not be otherwise.
"'For,' said he, "'all that is for the best. If there is a volcano at Lisbon, it cannot be elsewhere. It is impossible that things should be other than they are, for everything is right.'
A little man dressed in black, familiar of the Inquisition, who sat by him, politely took up his word and said,
"'Apparently, then, sir,' You do not believe in original sin, hm? For if all is for the best, there has then been neither fall nor punishment.
I humbly ask your excellency's pardon, answered Pangloss, still more politely, for the fall and curse of man necessarily entered into the system of the best of worlds.
Sir, said the familiar, you do not then believe in liberty?
Your excellency will excuse me, said Pangloss. "'Liberty is consistent with absolute necessity, for it was necessary we should be free. For, in short, the determinate will—'
Pangloss was in the middle of his sentence when the familiar beckoned to his footman, who gave him a glass of port wine. Chapter 6. How the Portuguese made a beautiful auto da fe to prevent any further earthquakes, and how Candide was publicly whipped. After the earthquake had destroyed 3/4 of Lisbon, the sages of that country could think of no means more effectual to prevent utter ruin than to give the people a beautiful auto da fe. For it had been decided by the University of Coimbra that the burning of a few people alive by a slow fire and with great ceremony is an infallible secret to hinder the earth from quaking. In consequence hereof, they had seized on a Biscayan, convicted of having married his godmother, and on 2 Portuguese for ejecting the bacon which larded a chicken they were eating. After dinner, they came and secured Dr. Pangloss and his disciple Candide, the one for speaking his mind, the other for having listened with an air of approbation. They were conducted to separate apartments, extremely cold, as they were never incommoded by the sun. 8 days after, they were dressed in sanbenitos, and their heads ornamented with paper mitres. The mitre and sanbenito belonging to Candide were painted with reversed flames and with devils that had neither tails nor claws. But Pangloss's devils had claws and tails, and the flames were upright. They marched in procession thus habited, and heard a very pathetic sermon, followed by fine church music. Candide was whipped in cadence while they were singing. The Biscayan and the 2 men who had refused to eat bacon were burnt, and Pangloss was hanged, though that was not the custom. The same day there was another earthquake which made most dreadful havoc. Candide, terrified, amazed, desperate, all bloody, all palpitating, said to himself, "If this is the best of possible worlds, what then are the others? Well, if I had been only whipped, I could put up with it, for I experienced that among the Bulgarians. But, oh, my dear Pangloss, thou greatest of philosophers, that I should have seen you hanged without knowing for what! Oh, my dear Anabaptist, thou best of men, that thou shouldst have been drowned in the very harbour! Oh, Miss Cunegonde, thou pearl of girls, that thou shouldst have had thy belly ripped open!" Thus he was musing, scarce able to stand, preached at, whipped, absolved, and blessed, when an old woman accosted him, saying, "My son, take a courage and follow me." Chapter 7. How the old woman took care of Candide, and how he found the object he loved. Candide did not take courage, but followed the old woman to a decayed house, where she gave him a pot of pomatum to anoint his sores, showed him a very neat little bed with a suit of clothes hanging up, and left him something to eat and drink.
"Eat, drink, sleep," said she, "and may Our Lady of Atocha, the great St. Anthony of Padua, and the great St. James of Compostela receive you under their protection. I shall be back tomorrow."
Candide, amazed at all he had suffered, and still more so with the charity of the old woman, wished to kiss her hand.
"Oh, it is not my hand you must kiss," said the old woman. "I shall be back tomorrow. Anoint yourself with the pomatum. Eat and sleep."
Candide, notwithstanding so many disasters, ate and slept. The next morning the old woman brought him his breakfast, looked at his back, and rubbed it herself with another ointment. In like manner she brought him his dinner, and at night she returned with his supper. The day following she went through the very same ceremonies. "Who are you?" said Candide. "Who has inspired you with so much goodness? What return can I make you?" The good woman made no answer. She returned in the evening, but brought no supper.
"Come with me," she said, "and say nothing."
She took him by the arm, and walked with him about a quarter of a mile into the country. They arrived at a lonely house, surrounded with gardens and canals. The old woman knocked at a little door. It opened. She led Candide up a private staircase into a small apartment richly furnished. She left him on a brocaded sofa, shut the door, and went away. Candide thought himself in a dream. Indeed, that he had been dreaming unluckily all his life, and that the present moment was the only agreeable part of it all. The old woman returned very soon, supporting with difficulty a trembling woman of a majestic figure, brilliant with jewels, and covered with a veil.
"Take off that veil," said the old woman to Candide.
The young man approaches. He raises the veil with a timid hand.
Oh, what a moment! What surprise! He believes he beholds Miss Cunegonde. He really sees her. It is herself. His strength fails him. He cannot utter a word, but drops at her feet. Cunegonde falls upon the sofa. The old woman supplies a smelling bottle.
They come to themselves and recover their speech, as they began with broken accents, with questions and answers interchangeably interrupted with sighs, with tears and cries. The old woman desired they would make less noise, and then she left them to themselves.
"What, is it you?" said Candide. "You live? I find you again in Portugal. Then you have not been ravished? Then they did not rip open your belly, as Dr. Pangloss informed me?"
"Yes, they did," said the beautiful Cunegonde. "But those two accidents are not always mortal."
"But were your father and mother killed?"
"It is but too true,"
answered Cunegonde in tears.
"And your brother?" "My brother was also killed."
"And why are you in Portugal? And how did you know of my being here? And by what strange adventure did you contrive to bring me to this house?"
"I will tell you all that," replied the lady. But first of all, let me know your history since the innocent kiss you gave me and the kicks which you received.
Candide respectfully obeyed her, and though he was still in a surprise, though his voice was feeble and trembling, though his back still pained him, yet he gave her a most ingenuous account of everything that had befallen him since the moment of their separation. Cunegonde lifted up her eyes to heaven, shed tears upon hearing of the death of the good Anabaptist and of Pangloss, after which she spoke as follows to Candide, who did not lose a word and devoured her with his eyes. Chapter 8. The History of Cunegonde.
I was in bed and fast asleep when it pleased God to send the Bulgarians to our delightful castle of Thunder Ten Tronck. They slew my father and brother and cut my mother in pieces. A tall Bulgarian, 6 feet high, perceiving that I had fainted away at this sight, began to ravish me. This made me recover. I regained my senses. I cried, I struggled, I bit, I scratched. I wanted to tear out the tall Bulgarian's eyes, not knowing that what happened at my father's house was the usual practice of war. The brute gave me a cut in the left side with his sword, and the mark is still upon me. Oh, I hope I shall see it, said honest Candide.
You shall, said Cunegonde, but let us continue.
Do so, replied Candide. Thus she resumed the thread of her story.
A Bulgarian captain came in, saw me all bleeding, and the soldier not in the least disconcerted. The captain flew into a passion at the disrespectful behaviour of the brute and slew him on my body. He ordered my wounds to be dressed and took me to his quarters as a prisoner of war. I washed the few shirts that he had. I did his cooking. He thought me very pretty. He avowed it. On the other hand, I must own he had a good shape and a soft white skin, but he had little or no mind or philosophy, and you might see plainly that he had never been instructed by Dr. Pangloss. In 3 months' time, having lost all his money and being tired of my company, he sold me to a Jew named Don Issachar, who traded to Holland and Portugal and had a strong passion for women. This Jew was much attached to my person, but could not triumph over it. I resisted him better than the Bulgarian soldier. A modest woman may be ravished once, but her virtue is strengthened by it. In order to render me more tractable, he brought me to this country house. Hitherto I had imagined that nothing could equal the beauty of Thunder Ten Tronck Castle, but I found I was mistaken. The Grand Inquisitor, seeing me one day at Mass, stared long at me and sent to tell me that he wished to speak on private matters. I was conducted to his palace, where I acquainted him with the history of my family, and he represented to me how much it was beneath my rank to belong to an Israelite. A proposal was then made to Don Issachar that he should resign me to my lord. Don Issachar, being the court banker and a man of credit, would hear nothing of it. The inquisitor threatened him with an auto da fe. At last, my Jew, intimidated, concluded a bargain by which the house and myself should belong to both in common. The Jew should have for himself Monday, Wednesday, and Saturday, and the inquisitor should have the rest of the week. It is now 6 months since this agreement was made. Quarrels have not been wanting, for they could not decide whether the night from Saturday to Sunday belonged to the old law or to the new. For my part, I have so far held out against both, and I verily believe that this is the reason why I am still beloved. At length, to avert the scourge of earthquakes and to intimidate Don Issachar, my Lord Inquisitor was pleased to celebrate an auto da fe. He did me the honour to invite me to the ceremony. I had a very good seat, and the ladies were served with refreshments between Mass and the execution. I was in truth seized with horror at the burning of 2 Jews and of the honest Biscayan who had married his godmother. But what was my surprise My fright, my trouble, when I saw in a San Benito and mitre a figure which resembled that of Pangloss. I rubbed my eyes, I looked at him attentively, I saw him hung, I fainted. Scarcely had I recovered my senses than I saw you, stripped, stark naked, and this was the height of my horror, consternation, grief, and despair. I tell you truthfully that your skin is yet whiter and of a more perfect colour than that of my Bulgarian captain. This spectacle redoubled all the feelings which overwhelmed and devoured me. I screamed out and would have said, "Stop, barbarians!" But my voice failed me, and my cries would have been useless after you had been severely whipped. "How is it possible," said I, "that the beloved Candide and the wise Pangloss should both be at Lisbon, the one to receive 100 lashes, and the other to be hanged by the Grand Inquisitor, of whom I am the well-beloved? Pangloss most cruelly deceived me when he said that everything in the world is for the best. Agitated, lost, sometimes beside myself, and sometimes ready to die of weakness, my mind was filled with the massacre of my father, mother, and brother, with the insolence of the ugly Bulgarian soldier, with the stab that he gave me, with my servitude under the Bulgarian captain, with my hideous Don Issachar, with my abominable inquisitor, with the execution of Dr. Pangloss, with the grand miserere to which they whipped you, and especially with the kiss I gave you behind the screen the day that I had last seen you. I praised God for bringing you back to me after so many trials, and I charged my old woman to take care of you and to conduct you hither as soon as possible. She has executed her commission perfectly well. I've tasted the inexpressible pleasure of seeing you again, of hearing you, of speaking with you. But you must be hungry. For myself, I am famished. Let us have supper."
They both sat down to table, and when supper was over, they placed themselves once more on the sofa, where they were when Signor Don Issachar arrived. It was the Jewish Sabbath, and Issachar had come to enjoy his rites and to explain his tender love. Chapter 9. What became of Cunegonde, Candide, the Grand Inquisitor, and the Jew? This Issachar was the most choleric Hebrew that had ever been seen in Israel since the captivity in Babylon. "What?" said he. "Thou bitch of a Galilean, was not the Inquisitor enough for thee? Must this rascal also share with me?" In saying this, he drew a long dagger, which he always carried about him, and not imagining that his adversary had any arms, he threw himself upon Candide. But our honest Westphalian had received a handsome sword from the old woman along with a suit of clothes. He drew his rapier, despite his gentleness, and laid the Israelite stone dead upon the cushions at Cunegonde's feet.
"Holy Virgin!" cried she. "What will become of us? A man killed in my apartment. If the officers of justice come, we are lost."
"Had not Pangloss been hanged," said Candide, "he would give us good counsel in this emergency, for he was a profound philosopher. Failing him, let us consult the old woman." She was very prudent, and commenced to give her opinion, when suddenly another little door opened. It was an hour after midnight. It was the beginning of Sunday. This day belonged to my lord the Inquisitor. He entered, and saw the whipped Candide, sword in hand, a dead man upon the floor, Cunegonde aghast, and the old woman giving counsel. At this moment, the following is what passed in the soul of Candide, and how he reasoned. "If this holy man call in assistance, he will surely have me burnt, and Cunegonde will perhaps be served in the same manner. He was the cause of my being cruelly whipped. He is my rival. And as I have now begun to kill, I will kill away, for there is no time to hesitate." This reasoning was clear and instantaneous, so that without giving time to the Inquisitor to recover from his surprise, he pierced him through and through, and cast him beside the Jew.
"Yet again," said Cunegonde, "now there is no mercy for us. We are excommunicated. Our last hour has come. How could you do it, you naturally so gentle, to slay a Jew and a prelate in 2 minutes? My beautiful young lady, responded Candide, when one is a lover, jealous and whipped by the Inquisition, one stops at nothing.
The old woman then put in her words, saying,
There are three Andalusian horses in the stable with bridles and saddles. Let the brave Candide get them ready. Madame has money, jewels. Let us therefore mount quickly on horseback, though I can sit only on one buttock. Let us sit out for Cadiz. It is the finest weather in the world. There is great pleasure in travelling in the cool of the night.
Immediately Candide saddled the three horses, and Cunegonde, the old woman, and he travelled 30 miles at a stretch. While they were journeying, the Holy Brotherhood entered the house. My lord the Inquisitor was interred in a handsome church, and Issachar's body was thrown upon a dunghill. Candide, Cunegonde, and the old woman had now reached the little town of Avicenna in the midst of the mountains of the Sierra Morena, and were speaking as follows in a public inn. Chapter 10. In what distress Candide, Cunegonde, and the old woman arrived at Cadiz, and of their embarkation.
"Who was it that robbed me of my money and jewels?" said Cunegonde, all bathed in tears. "Oh, how shall we live? What shall we do? Where find inquisitors or Jews who will give me more?"
"Ah, lass," said the old woman, "I have a shrewd suspicion of a reverend grey friar who stayed last night in the same inn with us at Badajoz. God preserve me from judging rashly, but he came into our room twice, and he set out upon his journey long before us."
"Alas," said Candide,
"dear Pangloss has often demonstrated to me that the goods of this world are common to all men, and that each has an equal right to them. But according to these principles, the Grey Friar ought to have left us enough to carry us through our journey. Have you nothing at all left, my dear Cunegonde?"
"Not a farthing," said she.
"What then must we do?" said Candide.
"Sell one of the horses," replied the old woman.
"I will ride behind Miss Cunegonde, though I can hold myself only on one buttock, and we shall reach Cadiz."
In the same inn, there was a Benedictine prior who bought the horse for a cheap price. Candide, Cunegonde, and the old woman, having passed through Lucena, Chillas, and Librixa, arrived at length at Cadiz. A fleet was there getting ready, and troops assembling to bring to reason the reverend Jesuit fathers of Paraguay, accused of having made one of the native tribes in the neighbourhood of San Sacrament revolt against the kings of Spain and Portugal. Candide, having been in the Bulgarian service, performed the military exercise before the general of this little army with so graceful an address, with so intrepid an air, and with such agility and expedition, that he was given the command of a company of foot. Now he was a captain. He set sail with Miss Cunegonde, the old woman, two valets, and the two Andalusian horses, which had belonged to the Grand Inquisitor of Portugal. During the voyage, they reasoned a good deal on the philosophy of poor Pangloss. "We are going into another world," said Candide, "and surely it must be there that all is for the best. For I must confess there is reason to complain a little of what passeth in our world in regard to both natural and moral philosophy."
"I love you with all my heart," said Cunegonde, "but my soul is still full of fright at that which I've seen and experienced."
"All will be well," replied Candide. "The sea of this new world is already better than our European sea. It is calmer, the winds more regular. It is certainly the new world which is the best of all possible worlds."
"God grant it," said Cunegonde. "But I have been so horribly unhappy in my world so far that my heart is almost closed to hope."
"You complain," said the old woman. "Alas, you have not known such misfortunes as mine."
Cunegonde almost broke out laughing, finding the good woman very amusing for pretending to have been as unfortunate as she.
"Alas," said Cunegonde, "my good mother, unless you have been ravished by two Bulgarians, have received two deep wounds in your belly, have had two castles demolished, have had two mothers cut to pieces before your eyes, and two of your lovers whipped at an auto da fe, I do not conceive how you could be more unfortunate than I. add that I was born a baroness of 72 quarterings, and have been a cook.
Miss, replied the old woman, you do not know my birth, and were I to show you my backside, you would not talk in that manner, but would suspend your judgment.
This speech having raised extreme curiosity in the minds of Cunegonde and Candide, the old woman spoke to them as follows. Chapter 11. History of the Old Woman.
I had not always bleared eyes and red eyelids, neither did my nose always touch my chin, nor was I always a servant. I am the daughter of Pope Urban X, and of the Princess of Palestrina. Until the age of 14, I was brought up in a palace, to which all the castles of your German barons would scarcely have served for stables, and one of my robes was worth more than all the magnificence of Westphalia. As I grew up, I improved in beauty, wit, and every graceful accomplishment, in the midst of pleasures, hopes, and respectful homage. Already I inspired love. My throat was formed, and such a throat, white, firm, and shaped like that of the Venus de Medici. And what eyes, what eyelids, what black eyebrows! Such flames darted from my dark pupils that they eclipsed the scintillation of the stars, as I was told by the poets in our part of the world. My waiting women, when dressing and undressing me, used to fall into an ecstasy, whether they viewed me before or behind. How glad would the gentlemen have been to perform that office for them! I was affianced to the most excellent prince of Massa Carrara. Such a prince! As handsome as myself, sweet-tempered, agreeable, brilliantly witty, and sparkling with love. I loved him as one loves for the first time, with idolatry, with transport. The nuptials were prepared. There was surprising pomp and magnificence. There were fete, carousals, continual opera bouffe. And all Italy composed sonnets in my praise, though not one of them was passable. I was just upon the point of reaching the summit of bliss, when an old marchioness, who had been mistress to the prince, my husband, invited him to drink chocolate with her. He died in less than 2 hours of most terrible convulsions. But this is only a bagatelle. My mother, in despair, and scarcely less afflicted than myself, determined to absent herself for some time from so fatal a place. She had a very fine estate in the neighbourhood of Gaeta. We embarked on board the galley of the country which was gilded like the great altar of St. Peter's at Rome. A sally corsair swooped down and boarded us. Our men defended themselves like the Pope's soldiers. They flung themselves upon their knees and threw down their arms, begging of the corsair an absolution in articulo mortis. Oh, instantly they were stripped as bare as monkeys. My mother, our maids of honour, and myself were all served in the same manner. It is amazing with what expedition those gentry undress people. But what surprised me most was that they thrust their fingers into the part of our bodies into which the generality of women suffer no other instrument to enter. It appeared to me a very strange kind of ceremony, but thus one judges of things when one has not seen the world. I afterwards learnt that it was to try whether we had concealed any diamonds. This is the practice established from time immemorial among civilized nations that scour the seas. I was informed that the very religious knights of Malta never fail to make this search when they take any Turkish prisoners of either sex. It is a law of nations from which they never deviate. I need not tell you how great a hardship it was for a young princess and her mother to be made slaves and carried to Morocco. You may easily imagine all we had to suffer on board the pirate vessel. My mother was still very handsome. Our maids of honour and even our waiting women had more charms than are to be found in all Africa.
As for myself, I was ravishing, was exquisite, grace itself, and I was a virgin. I did not remain so long. This flower, which had been reserved for the handsome prince of Massa-Carrara, was plucked by the corsair captain. He was an abominable negro, and yet believed that he did me a great deal of honour. Certainly the princess of Palestrina and myself must have been very strong to go through all that we experienced until our arrival at Morocco. But let us pass on. These are such common things as not to be worth mentioning. Morocco swam in blood when we arrived. 50 sons of the Emperor Moulay Ismail had each their adherents. This produced 50 civil wars of blacks against blacks, and blacks against tawnies, and tawnies against tawnies, and mulattoes against mulattoes. In short, it was a continual carnage throughout the empire. And no sooner were we landed than the blacks of a contrary faction to that of my captain attempted to rob him of his booty. Next to jewels and gold, we were the most valuable things he had. I was witness to such a battle as you have never seen in your European climates. The northern nations have not that heat in their blood, nor that raging lust for women so common in Africa. It seems that you, Europeans, have only milk in your veins. But it is vitriol, it is fire which runs in those of the inhabitants of Mount Atlas and the neighbouring countries. They fought with the fury of the lions, tigers, and serpents of the country to see who should have us. A Moor seized my mother by the right arm, while my captain's lieutenant held her by the left. A Moorish soldier had hold of her by one leg, and one of our corsairs held her by the other. Thus almost all our women were drawn in quarters by four men. My captain concealed me behind him, and with his drawn scimitar cut and slashed every one that opposed his fury. At length I saw all our Italian women, and my mother herself, torn, mangled, massacred by the monsters who disputed over them. The slaves, my companions, those who had taken them, soldiers, sailors, blacks, whites, mulattoes, and at last my captain, all were killed, and I remained dying on a heap of dead. Such scenes as this were transacted through an extent of 300 leagues, and yet they never missed the 5 prayers a day ordained by Mahomet. With difficulty I disengaged myself from such a heap of slaughtered bodies, and crawled to a large orange tree on the bank of a neighbouring rivulet, where I fell oppressed with fright, fatigue, horror, despair, and hunger. Immediately after, my senses, overpowered, gave themselves up to sleep, which was yet more swooning than repose. I was in this state of weakness and insensibility, between life and death, when I felt myself pressed by something that moved upon my body. I opened my eyes and saw a white man of good countenance who sighed, and who said between his teeth, "O che schiagura d'essere senza coglioni!"